Chapter 15, The Incompetence Button.
I can't do anything right. I'm a mess, is the lament of the parent who feels incompetent. When a parent considers himself incompetent, inadequate, or a failure, he feels powerless to influence, to teach, to be authoritative, to parent. He looks to everyone else for the answers, cannot trust himself, and certainly does not trust his child. The incompetent parent is at risk for giving over power, being overly permissive, and becoming a doormat for the rest of the family, perhaps burdening others with the responsibility of doing the job that he doesn't believe he's up to. It's natural for this parent to lay blame on his child for his own shortcomings, asking his child to compensate, to make it better for him so he won't have to feel so badly about himself. This parent can present himself as the victim when he says he's incapable of doing anything about the problem. Victims feel powerless but often exhibit power in their victim role by being helpless and requiring someone else to compensate for their inabilities. They also tend to take on too much responsibility, being convinced it's their job, even though they don't know what to do about it. It becomes another reason to blame themselves. When their button is pushed, incompetent parents feel helpless, hopeless, or invisible, and give themselves little or no credit. Children of these parents may either play on the parent's subservient role, take the power and run with it, or they may be left with guilt for what they are not able to do to make their parent happy. When children push the incompetence button, they're asking their parents to step into their power, feel confident in their decisions, and take control. It's my responsibility, isn't it? Shelley and Tyler, age 7. Okay, what did I do wrong? A frustrated Shelley asked the class. I bought Tyler this Lego Robotron he's been wanting for a long time. We got in the car to go home, and he begged me to open it. I told him that he would lose the pieces and would be upset. He said he would be careful and kept begging, so I gave in. Sure enough, he was putting it together in the living room, and 11 pieces were missing. I was furious. I yelled at him, "I told you so," and then he cried and told me it was all my fault. The whole thing was a horrible mess. I've been upset about it ever since. I set out to do something nice for him, and it turned out rotten.
So did you look in the car for the pieces? Another mother asked.
Oh, yes, but 4 are still missing.
So can't he build other things with it? They asked.
Shelley said, I don't think so. I think that's it. Anyway, I took it away and put it in the closet.
Of course he can build other things with it. Is he upset about the 4 pieces? A father asked.
No, Shelley said, a little embarrassed. I'm the one who's upset about it.
Why have you made it your problem? I asked Shelley.
She looked confused.
He lost the pieces. It's his toy. He's responsible for the lost pieces.
But I'm the one who's so mad, she said.
Exactly. That's what tells me you've made it your problem. Can you identify the assumptions you had at the time?
She listed them. He's disorganized and careless. He's going to grow up without any care for his things. I haven't taught him how to be organized.
So what standard are you using that generates those thoughts? I asked.
Shelley was stumped. We all came up with them together. My child must be organized and careful with his things at all times. It's my responsibility to teach him organizational skills.
Are you organized? Someone asked.
No, I'm terrible, and it makes me so mad. I don't want Tyler to grow up like me. I can't keep anything straight. And then I get mad at my husband for not knowing where something is.
But, Shelley, aren't you forgetting that Tyler is 7? He's a kid, and kids lose things.
If it doesn't upset him, what's the big deal? One of the class members asked.
It's also the money. That's a big issue with me. I just spent money on this toy, and already it's wrecked, Shelley added.
A different mother piped in.
But you bought it. It was your choice to buy it for him. That's done. Now it's his. Can you let go of it?
Someone else said, it sounds like you're expecting him to be perfect, like a doll.
Shelley looked pensive. She was listening hard, but she still felt stuck.
The problem is, I don't think there's anything wrong with my assumptions. I think they're true.
Okay, let's look at the whole piece, I said. First, you liked the way you reacted. Was it helpful?
No, I hated it. I was very upset, and it definitely was not helpful.
So your reaction was caused by your emotions. You were furious with him and furious with yourself. We've said that your emotions cannot be controlled, only suppressed or acted on, but your assumptions are what cause your emotions. So if you don't like your reaction, the problem must be in your assumptions. If your assumptions seem accurate, there must be another way of looking at it that you haven't thought of. Are your expectations appropriate? Several others seem to think they're not. Shelley thought for a minute.
I think I'm beginning to see something. I'm putting more importance on Tyler's things than I am on him. It's the material objects that are getting in my way of letting go of taking responsibility for everything. If everything is your responsibility, then you're always at fault when something goes wrong, I said. Absolutely, she responded. And when we went over the situation later and I asked him what we could have done differently, I said, "Do you think I should have let you open the box?" And he said, "No, you shouldn't have let me." I was left feeling blamed. Again.
It sounds like you set yourself up to feel incompetent, I said, which happens when you think everything is your responsibility. Tyler had his out. He could make it all your fault, and you took it. So he never had to take responsibility for himself. We discussed how the situation could have gone differently. Shelley could have said in the car, "The risk of opening the box is that pieces will get lost. Do you understand that?" If he still wanted to open it, she could have noted that it was his choice and then let go. When pieces were missing, it would then be his problem, not hers. He would then be given the opportunity to understand cause and effect, trial and error. He could internalize the risks of making that choice and learn something for next time. If he gets to blame his mother, he doesn't learn anything.
But what should she do then, someone asked. Should she help him find the pieces?
I suggested that it didn't matter whether she helped him or not. If she knew it was his problem and not hers, she could empathize with his being upset about the missing pieces. She could offer to help him, or she could let him do it on his own, whichever felt right. If she's upset about the pieces but he isn't, the problem is hers. If he continues not to care about his things, it might be a good idea to let him start saving money and buying them himself. The important piece is to allow him to have his problem so that he can learn from it.
I get it, Shelley said. He can't learn if I take the blame, and I give myself the blame so he won't be unhappy. The problem is I end up feeling like a failure. But he has a right to be unhappy, and his unhappiness might motivate him to take better care of his things.
Yes, you did get it, I beamed back at her. It seemed like everyone in the room got it.
I think it will be wise for you to write a new standard for yourself that releases you from all the responsibility you carry. Parenting Tyler will be much easier when you do.
I'm nothing, so you'd better be something.
Kate, Tucker 5, and Misha 3. When I asked a new Buttons group what had brought them to the class, Kate said, "I hit rock bottom with Tucker the other night, but it was the best thing that happened to me. We were both out of control, and then all of a sudden it hit. I'm 36, and he's 5. I'm the one who has to change."
"Misha is just like me," Kate said. "She's built just like me. She looks like me. She acts like me. Tucker is much more out there, putting it in your face, and he puts it in Misha's face all the time." Kay was worried about the sibling rivalry between her two children. She saw Tucker as the instigator and Misha as the victim. I asked Kate where she fit in her family of origin. "I'm the youngest of 4, she said. "I have 2 older sisters and an older brother. Plus, I'm the youngest of all my extended family. All my siblings and all my cousins teased me and put me down constantly. They treated me like nothing."
"Where were your parents in all of this?" I asked. "Did they do anything to protect you?"
"They made sure it didn't happen around my parents. My father actually didn't care. He treated me like nothing, too, but my mother didn't really know about it."
"You didn't tell her?" I asked.
"No. I didn't want her to have any more to deal with than she already had dealing with my father."
Sounds like you've identified with Misha, the youngest, and the girl, and don't want her to suffer what you did. I wonder if Tucker reminds you of your older siblings, and it pushes your buttons when you see him taunting Misha like you were taunted. You fall right back into your sibling role and resent what he's doing. What's your standard for Tucker's behavior? Without hesitating, Kate said that he always acts in a way that makes others feel good about themselves or do nothing at all. I suggested that was a tall order. What about Tucker's feelings? I asked. She looked pensive. Did you do that in your family? I prodded. The story came out without reservation. My father was a violently angry man. He blamed everything on someone else. If any one of us opened a door that knocked against a chair that bumped his foot, he would yell, "You did that on purpose." He never hit, but he sure blamed us a lot. I was envious of my older sister because she didn't take it. She would say back to him, "Don't be ridiculous. Why would I want to make you mad?" And he'd back off. I was just scared. I lived on fear and guilt. So I did everything I could to avoid his rage and to make him happy. She added that everyone made fun of her and called her Big Katie and Fatty. She confessed that she struggled with weight all her life. She hates her solid build and once again said how Misha is built just like her. She's tried all kinds of diets, but nothing has worked to get her weight where she wants it. I was always trying to avoid teasing and criticism, so basically I tried to be invisible. My mother was my savior, Kate added. We're like each other's best friend, but strangely, I don't go to very deep places with her. I keep her at bay. Actually, I keep most people at bay. Kate gestured with her palm facing out. I don't really know why. My mother did blame us for doing whatever we did to set my father off. It sounds like your mother needed to side with her husband, possibly to keep the marriage intact, I suggested. Maybe you learned that she wasn't completely trustworthy. Well, now that you mention it, I always blamed my father for everything, but lately I've been feeling really angry with her. I guess that's why. And you're right, I don't trust her. She's always making these subtle, backhanded comments about my weight, like, "You don't want another cookie," when she's handing them out to everyone else, or telling my niece right in front of me how trim she keeps herself and how beautiful her clothes are, saying, "Don't you wish you could wear something like that, Kate?" Ugh, it makes me want to kill her. I suspected that the abuse she grew up with was the reason for her protective layer. The shame that Kate felt as a child, shame that told her she was the problem, she was at fault for making her father mad, for being too big, for being a nothing for all to make fun of, had seeped into her subconscious. As a result, she keeps herself in hiding from others in order to keep them at bay, so they don't see the real person inside. When Tucker makes fun of Misha, hits her and gets in her face, it triggers Kate's shame and reminds her of those unpleasant memories. She projects her experience onto Misha and doesn't want Tucker to treat Misha like a nothing. She wants to protect Misha from feeling the deep agony she felt, so she reacts with blame toward Tucker, who is quickly learning to see himself as the problem. "It seems as if you're trying to make Tucker treat Misha the way you wanted to be treated," I suggested, "a natural and logical goal. However, with your standard telling you children must act in a way that makes others feel good about themselves or do nothing at all, you're taking responsibility for Misha and giving Tucker no room to have his own feelings. If he's expected to make Misha feel good and she doesn't, you are unintentionally setting him up for feeling bad. It's not his job to make Misha feel good about herself. You're asking him to be responsible for other people's feelings and ignore his own, a job you had taken on to survive. But Tucker doesn't have to do that to survive, and Misha is not learning to stand up for herself if you protect her." We looked at how all the pieces fit. Kate's belief, "I'm worthless and a nothing," leads her to develop the standard, "Children must act in ways that make others feel good," that makes her children compensate for what she never got. Paradoxically, this standard is beginning to create the same bad feelings in Tucker that Kate experienced, because her father expected her to behave in ways that made him feel good. But Kate took it all inside to try to be invisible. Tucker is acting his feelings out. As soon as Kate realized that she was unintentionally passing this pattern on, she immediately stopped herself. She could see that she had been defending Misha against Tucker,
setting him up as the bad guy, and he was buying it. Tucker needed what she had needed, to have his feelings accepted, to be treated with respect. Kate came in the next week feeling stronger. "I had a great week with the kids," she beamed. "My standard has changed, and I think Tucker feels it." He was poking Misha, and she was whining at him to make him stop, all the while looking at me pleadingly. I told her that she had every right to tell him how mad she was, which she did. Tucker complained that she had taken the book he was reading and hid it. I said, "Wow, really? I can see why you'd be angry at her. Can you tell her what you want instead of poking her?" He looked at me as if I'd handed him a huge present. He said with a rather fierce tone, "Misha, please get me my book and give it to me." Lo and behold, Misha went and got the book. Tucker looked at me, and we shared a knowing smile. It felt great. It's amazing what just being a little more aware of the layers underneath can do to change things. I could let go of taking care of Misha, and I saw that she's perfectly capable of taking care of herself. If only I were a better mother. Lee, Jerry, and Robbie, age 4. Lee had put up with Robbie's stinky, dirty feet for a long time before she realized she was actually capable of doing something about it. Robbie loved his red rubber boots. Whenever he was at home, his shoes would come off and on would go his rubber boots. Often his clothes came off as well. He loved the feeling of no restrictions on his body, but his rubber boots had become a second skin. Lee and Jerry had no problem with their son running around at home with no clothes, nor did they have a problem with his rubber boots. But Lee did have a problem with his feet when the boots came off. No matter how often she washed out the insides of the boots, after a few hours of hard playing, Robbie's feet were still a problem. The smell and the grime between the toes were leaving spots on her new couch and interfering with an otherwise pleasant dinner hour. Anytime Lee suggested washing Robbie's feet, he would shriek, "No!" and Lee would leave him alone. Jerry, on the other hand, would drag him off and clean them himself, telling Lee she was too easy on him. "Jerry's reactions make it even harder for me to be firm," she confessed. "I don't want to ruffle Robbie's feathers," she said with a laugh. So I would say, "Please take your feet off the couch, Rob," being as polite and respectful as I could be. Robbie would say, "No, I don't have to." I could feel my blood start to boil. But I would bite my tongue and say, "I would really like you to, sweetie." I would be ignored, and then I couldn't say any more about it. It was like he was pointing out to me what a pathetic, worthless parent I was. "So actually, Robbie doesn't have to take his feet off the couch, does he?" I asked. "You mean because I let it go?" "You're right. When he says he doesn't have to, he knows he doesn't have to." "I'm such a pushover. I can't make him do anything." Lee desperately wanted to be a good mother. She and Jerry had tried for a long time to get pregnant. After thinking it would never happen, they tried fertility drugs, but even that didn't work. Just as they had given up hope, she became pregnant. Lee was so grateful to have a baby that he could do no wrong, until her button started to get pushed. "It feels like I'm taking something away from him if I tell him no," she admitted genuinely. "I look at him and think, oh, the poor thing. I can never willingly or knowingly cause his unhappiness. I know I'm spoiling him, but I feel so guilty and blame myself unmercifully if I say no to anything. It just isn't worth it." The fear of being a bad mother had Lee trapped. Meeting Robbie's needs was her first priority. She ended up pleading with him to do whatever she wanted. Her pleading automatically put her in a submissive role, and she let him win every time. But when her button began getting pushed, she imploded into anxiety and self-doubt for fear of getting mad at Robbie. Lee had been pampered as a child herself. She worried that she was too spoiled to be a good enough parent. Desperate to prove herself wrong, she compensated by never doing what she wanted, never putting her own needs first. So Robbie had come to rule the roost. Robbie had taken all the power in the relationship, and his behavior had become quite aggressive. His resistance to her requests for him to be calm and polite got louder and louder. "Occasionally I blow," Lee confessed. "It's like I've torn him apart. He screams at me, 'You hate me!' I can't stand that. So I apologize and get him a present or something." The turning point came on Easter morning in church.
He was demanding, loud, and rude, she said. The whole congregation heard him when he told the man next to us to move over and give him more room. I wanted to crawl under the pew. I realized then that I had no control over him, and I had to do something fast. We took him out, and I sent him home with Jerry and told him he could not go to his grandparents for Easter dinner. He had a major tantrum. He adores his grandparents, who, of course, dote on him like they did on me. But surprisingly, he quickly settled down. He almost seemed happier and went home without a fuss. Later on, when I got home, he was sweeter and more cooperative than he'd ever been. We went for a bike ride and had the best time together. I wonder if all this time his aggressive behavior has been a signal to you to stop him and set restrictions on his behavior, I said. I thought the same thing, she answered. Lee had to learn that her own needs were not only important to her growth and development, but also to Robbie's. Her fears of being an incompetent mother only led him to take advantage. Respecting herself was in his best interest, too. After her success on Easter, Lee felt ready to tackle the boots and grungy feet. She worked it out with self-talk first, telling herself that her desire for clean feet on the couch was justified, and that the balance of their needs was her ultimate goal. The next day she said to him, "Robbie, from now on you will have a choice. Either you will wash your feet after you take your boots off, or you will not be allowed to wear your boots again. It's important to me that our furniture stays clean and that we do not have to smell dirty feet. The choice is yours." "Okay, Mom, I'll wash my feet." Lee was dumbfounded. She regularly has to remind him, but he does wash his feet with only a mild grumble. Lee's new perception includes her own needs. I count. I can ask him to do what I want, too, and still be a good mother, meet Robbie's needs, and claim my authority. She repeated this over and over to herself until it sank in. She came to the last class with a new story. Robbie was going out to ride his bike, and I was on the phone. His motorcycle goggles were not fitting under his helmet the right way, and he got very angry. He pulled off the helmet and hurled it across the room, breaking my antique vase. I hung up the phone, picked up the helmet, and without a word put it on top of the refrigerator. Before, I would have thought, "Oh, the poor thing," and put his helmet on the right way and sent him off to ride, seething over my vase. "But I didn't," she said proudly. Robbie lost control. He raged and flung himself at me, screaming, "No! I want my helmet! I have to ride my bike!" I held him tightly with his back to me, but he began crashing his head into my chest. I picked him up, kicking and flailing, took him to his room, and sat with him while he had his tantrum. When he finished, I held him for a few minutes. He said, "Can I go out now?" I said, "If you're ready to change your behavior and be calm, you can." He was cooperative for the rest of the day. We discussed how he would take responsibility for the vase and agreed that he would pay $5 toward a new one to be taken out of his allowance over the next 2 months. Lee learned that in order to be a better mother, she must find a way to say no. Her automatic reaction is to give in and give up. If she had reacted in the old way, Robbie would not have been held accountable for his behavior. Typically, this style of reactive parenting results in children feeling entitled to what they want with no respect for the rights of others. Responsibility always belongs to someone else. Communication with potentially influential adults is near impossible, and a deep gap develops. She has shared many setbacks into her self-critical judgments, but she's learning that when she falls into the victim role, she gives Robbie way too much power. It's that imbalanced power that causes his anger and unhappiness. Not hearing her say no.